Okay, good evening. I want to thank Stephanie for really coordinating and encouraging us to get together to have this class. And we dedicate our learning this evening and our commitment to apply our learning this evening in the memory of our dear and beloved friend, Rav Baruch Tzvi ben Reuven Nassan, Rabbi Dr. Brian Galbit. The idea was to try to convene before the Yomim Tovim, and it's sort of the opposite of what we normally do, which is we normally focus a lot on the minutiae and the details, like before Pesach, at the expense of the deeper meaning. This time of year, we focus so much on the deeper meaning and the personal growth, sometimes at the expense of the details and minutiae, assuming everyone knows it and taking it for granted, even as technology changes, appliance change, the kitchens change, and the world is changing, and it deserves to be addressed again. So I want to begin, before we delve into the minutiae and the details and the laws, I always like to try to introduce it with something inspirational, not to get lost and think that the details are a means unto themselves, or an ends unto themselves, rather. The details, of course, are the means of the vehicle towards a greater ends. Yontif is to transform us. It's supposed to elevate us. It's supposed to enrich us. We happen to have a rigid set of rules for how to achieve that. But if we become hyper-focused and obsessive about the rules at the expense of the deeper meaning and the purpose, then we've lost out, really, on what it's all about. The Nevi'im, in the Sefer Malachim, in the Navi, it describes the month of Tishrei. We're now in Elul, but Rosh Hashanah launches the month of Tishrei. And the Navi Malachim describes the month of Tishrei as Yerach Ha'esanim. Yerach Ha'esanim, which means the month of those who are strong. It's an ambiguous comment. It's a title given to the month. It's the month of those who are strong. Who are those strong? To whom is the Pasuk, is the Navi referring? So the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah tells us, and Daf Yud Aleph, that the month of Tishrei is filled with an incredible amount of mitzvos. So the stronger are those who can persevere and properly fulfill and execute their responsibility and their obligation and all the many mitzvos. When Yocheved and I were first dating a few centuries ago, we did so around, it just happens to be, our dating began, we were introduced the month of Elul and Tishrei, and I'm proud, and I think part of the responsibility of our successful marriage is that it began on the foundation of mitzvos. Our early dates were to go do mitzvos together. So we did, I took her out to eat also, don't worry, it wasn't a cheap date. We did kaparis on one mitzvah, and we did tashlich on one date, rather, and we decorated a sukkah on a date. So Yerach Ha'esanim, the month of Tishrei, is filled with mitzvahs. There's no shortage of mitzvahs, opportunities to be able to do. That's the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah Daf Yud Aleph. Others suggest that the month is called Yerach Ha'esanim, the month of the strong, because Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov were all born in the month of Tishrei. Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov are the pillars of strength of the world. Upon them and our matriarchs, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Valeah, our entire world rests. And that is what it means, that this is the month of the strong. We were introduced and they support us, they hold us up. But perhaps there's a third meaning, and it's relevant to all of you. Yerach Ha'esanim, the month of those who are strong, means those who are going to cook 20 meals over the month of Tishrei. Between night and daytime, Yontif and Shabbos, before the fast and after the fast, you are gladiators, you are warriors, you are ninjas, you are, I don't know what else, you are triathletes and iron women. But to be able to persevere, Yerach Ha'esanim, so part of it is coming to shul a lot, doing mitzvahs a lot, davening a lot, takes strength and endurance. It also takes strength and endurance to be able to make it through. And I want to explain that all that time in the kitchen cooking, preparing, serving, which I am not assuming only applies to one gender. It applies to anyone. We all should help out in that arena and in that area. But that's among the holiest part of Yontif. It's not that that's a necessary evil of Yontif. Real Yontif is davening and learning and being transformed in Tashlich. Oh yeah, the meals are this necessary evil people will need to eat, so I guess I have to cook. And the shopping and the slaving in the kitchen is just a necessary evil of Yontif. It is Yontif. The Yontif table, the conversations, the Divrei Torah, the Zmiros, the generosity, the hospitality, the friendship, the unity, that is Yontif. The table is the place where all of that happens. In Shul, we're not supposed to talk. We're not supposed to have the companionship and the camaraderie and the unity. That is at the table. And so when we break bread together, when we're eating these holy meals together, it's the most enriching, uplifting part. When we go out of our way to think about those who might be alone, those who haven't received invitations, those who might be particularly fragile this Yontif and could use some support, some love, an invitation, some companionship, that is the holiest part of Yontif. But it's a kavana that we have to have. It's a kavana that we have to have. There's so many motions that we go through in life and we do them externally and we fail to give them the intention and the mindfulness that they deserve, which is exactly what would elevate and transform them. I mentioned, I think this morning in the Emunah Shir, maybe yesterday also in the Parsha Shir, it's in our Parsha, Lo avarti mitzvosecha velo shachachti, the Sfas Emes says, Lo avarti mitzvosecha, I didn't neglect doing your mitzvos. Check, I did each mitzvah. But velo shachachti means, and I didn't forget what I was supposed to be thinking about while I did it. We often arrive at a destination, we don't remember how we got there. We finish davening and close the siddur, we don't remember saying one word. And we're losing that mindfulness, that intention, which is the core of what Yahadus, what the Torah is supposed to do. It enriches our lives, it animates our lives, it inspires our lives by being fully present, by having an intention and a mindfulness while we're doing. So the last thing I'll say about this, and then we'll delve into some of the details. The pasuk tells us that when Yitzchak marries Rivka, he brings Rivka back into the tent of his mother. And Rashi quotes the Chazal there that there were several miracles that happened in that tent. The candle never went out. And one of those great things is bracha mitsuya be'isa. Bracha mitsuya be'isa. Blessing was found in the dough. Sara Imenu had a remarkable effect that her dough, her challah, came out blessed. And Rivka inherited that quality. It was never lost. It never left that tent, even when Rivka moved in, says Rashi. So how do you understand what that means? Bracha mitsuya be'isa. Like the challah came out perfect every time. It rose exactly the way it was supposed to, and the braid was beautiful. And is that what it means? That the challah never bombed? It always came out perfect? Maybe. Some understand what it means. Bracha mitzuya be'isa is even though it was small, it expanded, and there was enough for everybody. But the Imre Pinchas, or Pinchas of Koritz, one of the great Hasidic Rebbes, he says, bracha mitzuya be'isa means Sara Imenu put her all into that dough. And Rivka inherited that same quality. The food that we eat carries the love and the mindfulness and the intention that was put into it. And while a person is shopping and cooking and preparing, they're filled with negativity and complaints and bitterness and resentment, then the food will transmit and contaminate whoever consumes it with those qualities. And if the food has absorbed the love and the joy and the positivity and the energy and the spirituality, you know, what are we listening to while we're cooking? Are we listening to a shir? Are we listening to a Dvar Torah? Are we listening to wonderful, uplifting Jewish music? Or are we yapping Lashon Hara into our AirPod while we're maneuvering around the kitchen and cooking? Are we complaining? Are we saying Lashon Hara? So the environment of the cooking that we're doing, and I'm not like a heebie-jeebie guy, but I really believe this from the bottom of my heart, the energy that we create and the environment that we provide is absorbed into the food. It goes into the food, and it is what we will be feeding our family and feeding our guests, which places an awesome responsibility on the people shopping and cooking and preparing to be filled with love and positivity and good energy and emuna and the themes of Rosh Hashanah while they're cooking. So if I could be mechazek you to try to have a level of intention, a level of mindfulness, to create an environment and an aura that is elevated, dafka while you're cooking, because that food on Rosh Hashanah will absorb all of that. And it's such a shame, it's such a crime that so much work goes into it. A magnificently set table with fine china and silver and crystal, an enormous and diverse menu with every delicacy under the planet. And yet, if the table is filled with gossip and banter and any tension or hostility or negativity, what's the point of all that? All of that is there to complement what is the core. And so it needs to carry that energy too. Okay, let's get started. So we're going to cover a few different areas of halacha, mostly in the kitchen, but really it's whatever you want. Stephanie was kind enough to put some questions together. I received questions from others, and we'll try to get through them. So we'll start with kitchen issues. Remind me to come back to bathing a child on Yom Tov. I was asked to talk about that as well. But some kitchen issues. So let's go. The halacha is that Yom Tov is different than Shabbos in this area. We have a pasuk in Parshas Bo which says, "Ach asher ye'achel l'chol nefesh." The pasuk says something which is eaten by everybody. Ach limits. It means that only something which would be eaten universally, l'chol nefesh. We have a pasuk in Parshas Emma which says, kol malachas avoda lo sa'asu. When it comes to Shabbos, we're prohibited from all malacha. We have 39 categories of creative labor that are forbidden on Shabbos. Not labor. You're allowed to walk to shul in Boca in August. Labor is not what's prohibited. Creative labor. Creative labor is defined as something only a human ingenuity would achieve. If a monkey could do it, it's not creative labor. A monkey could walk to shul. And a monkey can schlep furniture, but a monkey could never invent electricity and flip a light switch. A monkey could never invent a car. So those 39 categories are what Chazal understood from the juxtaposition in the Torah. Whatever went into the building of the Mishkan, whatever contributed to building holiness, is considered a meaningful, a malachas machsheves. That is a creative labor, which is called creative, that we refrain from, we abstain from on Shabbats. So 6 days a week we create, we conquer the world, we manipulate the world, we're in charge of the world, we control nature. And one day a week we say, nature, we're good, we're at peace with you. We're at peace with you. You do your thing, we do our thing. We're not trying to control you. One day a week. What forms of nature are we not trying to control? We have these 39 categories. So the Pasuk says, when it comes to Shabbos, kol malacha, you're not allowed to do any creative labor. When it comes to Yontif, it's malachas avoda. It's a certain type of malacha. Which type of malacha is forbidden? Ach, asher yechol lechol nefesh. The other Pasuk, the Ramban explains, it's the other Pasuk that tells us the malacha that's permissible on Yontif, that's forbidden on Shabbos, are the malachas that are about cooking. When it comes to cooking, asher yachel l'chol nefesh. So, still can't drive, you still can't use electricity, you still can't do all the other malachos, but something that's contributed to eating, to preparing food, that is something which is permissible specifically on Shabbos. Even on Shabbos, when that is permissible, it's only permissible for things you could not have done from before Shabbos, which is one of the reasons given why you cannot light a new flame on Shabbos. There's a debate, what is the source or origin? Most assume it's derabbanan, it's a rabbinic prohibition that you can't light a new flame on Shabbos, which is why, by the way, you could ask a non-Jew to do it, because really it's rabbinically prohibited. You could ask the non-Jew to light a flame for you, but you can only light a flame from a previously existing flame. So some say the reason is it's molid. You're creating something new that didn't exist. You're not allowed to be molid. Others suggest because you could have lit the flame from before Yontif and just had a continuous long-lasting light or continue to light new flames. So something you could have done from before Yontif, you can't do on Yontif. But things that need to be done on Yontif or would even make the quality fresher, better, then you're allowed to do it specifically on Yontif. So how does that apply in the kitchen? So you're allowed to cook on Yontif. You're allowed to cook on Yontif. You can't prepare from one day to the next. That's prohibited. That which the Torah permits us to cook on Yontif is only for that day. You're not allowed to cook from one day to the next. That is a desecration. It's a violation of the other day. You can't cook from Yontif to a weekday. You can't even cook from Yontif to another day of Yontif. And that applies even to Rosh Hashanah. Why would I think it would not apply to Rosh Hashanah? What's different about Rosh Hashanah from other holidays? Rosh Hashanah is fundamentally different. And we'll go on a tangent for a moment for me to explain that. Why do we have 2 days of Yontif here in America? The greatest impetus to make Aliyah is one day of Yontif and free tuition. So why do we have 2 days here? Why do we have 2 days here and one day there? Where does that come from? So we know that the way that we sanctified, the way that we determined the Jewish calendar, the way we determined when the holidays fall, is two witnesses would see the new moon, they'd go to Beis Din, they'd go to court, they'd testify they saw the new moon, Beis Din would accept the testimony, they would declare a new month, and based on the declaration of when the new month began, would determine when the holidays fell in Israel. So when they declared it, and they determined, because a month could either be 29 days or 30 days, so you needed the witnesses to come, because we have a lunar, we follow the moon, not the sun. So the moon, the lunar calendar functions differently, a month can either be 29 or 30 days, witnesses have to come and testify which it is, that establishes the new month, and that establishes the calendar for that month. How would you know that? If you live in Modi'in and they're going to Yerushalayim where they're declaring it, very simple. They would send out shlichim. They had agents who, as soon as they declared the new month, it was before WhatsApp and email and voicemail, they would send out, they would light fires on the mountaintops, and then we had enemies that tried to, they would light fires to confuse us. So they sent out agents who would go report. In Israel, you can make it anywhere within the boundaries of Israel by the time a holiday would start. So in Israel, you'd be able to tell all the inhabitants and the residents of Israel when the new month was, therefore when the holiday was, and by the time they encountered that holiday, they would know which day of the week, which day of that month to observe it. But in outside of Israel, in the diaspora, they couldn't get agents everywhere. So what happened? Outside of Israel, you wouldn't know. It could be 29 or 30 days, so you wouldn't know when the month began, and therefore when to observe the holiday. So the rabbis declared we observe 2 days. 2 days misafik, out of doubt, we don't know which is the real day, we declare 2 days. What happened even after they established a set calendar? Why are we still keeping 2 days? I can go on the internet right now and tell you exactly the calendar in 3,000 years from now. So why can't we just go down to one day? So the answer is, minhag avoseinu biyadeinu, they sent, the Gemara says, they sent from Israel to outside of Israel, saying, don't stop observing 2 days. Why? Because you never know when enemies will rise, corrupt our calendar, or prohibit us from observing in a certain way. So we preserve the custom in our time, the custom of our ancestors, and we continue to observe 2 days anywhere outside of Israel. There's one holiday in Israel which is an exception, where even in Israel, they couldn't get to all the places of Israel to tell them in time. And which holiday is that? Rosh Hashanah. Yom Kippur is the 10th. You have plenty of time. 10th of Tishrei. Sukkah is the 15th of Tishrei. You got plenty of time. Pesach is the 15th of Nisan. You have plenty of time. Shavuos, you have time. But Rosh Hashanah, you didn't have time. So in Israel, they instituted keeping a second day, even in Israel itself, only for Rosh Hashanah. Now, not everybody agrees. There's an opinion of the Baal HaMor, who says originally in Israel they only had 1 day of Rosh Hashanah. There's a great story where one of the American students came to Gush and asked Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, you know, every American in Israel doesn't know, do I keep 1 day, do I keep 2 days, what's my family's custom, you know, what do we do, what am I supposed to do, what do I want to do? So he went to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein's Zatzal, and he said, before Rosh Hashanah, you know, I'm new, I'm in the yeshiva, and my first time in Israel, I'm not sure how many days to keep. Which, it's a funny question, because Rosh Hashanah is not the time to ask it. You ask it about Sukkot, Rosh Hashanah, everybody keeps 2 days. But Rav Aaron was such a tzaddik, and he didn't want to make this boy feel bad. He said, you know, it's true, the Baal HaMor is the opinion. It's 1 day, it's a good question. There is an opinion 1 day. But I think that the mainstream normative practice is to keep 2 days in Israel. Everybody does. A testament to Rav Aaron's humility and his greatness. So even in the time of the Beis HaMikdash already, they were keeping 2 days of Rosh Hashanah. Because Rosh Hashanah is different. In Israel, they keep 2 days as an enactment, not out of doubt. And that's why it's called the Yom HaArichta. It's one long day. Which is why there's a question of saying the Shechianu. Every other holiday except for the last days of Pesach, we make a Shechianu each of the nights. Why? Because we don't know which is the real night. So since we don't know which is the real night, we say the Shechianu as if each night was the real night. But maybe when it comes to Rosh Hashanah, where I'm really just treating it as one long day, it's a 48-hour day instead of a 24-hour day, maybe I should only say the Shechianu at the beginning. How do I know I should say a Shechianu? It's different than every other 2 day Yontif. This was a takana in Israel to treat it as a 1 48-hour day. So maybe you should just make one Shechianu. So that's why we hedge, wear new clothing, eat a new fruit, do something else which would obligate you to make a Shechianu. So that way, in case you shouldn't make the Shechianu, you're covered by something else you're making the Shechianu on. That's just a custom. We paskin, really, you do make the Shechianu. Even if you didn't have access to a new fruit, and you weren't wearing new clothing, and there was nothing to make the Shechianu on, we would still make the Shechianu the second night, because even though we say it's a Yom HaArichta, it's one long day, we still treat it as 2 days in regards to the Shechianu. We'll come back to the kitchen in a moment, but while I'm on the Shechianu, let me address another fascinating area. I'm curious, actually, by a show of hands, how many make a Shechianu when lighting candles for Yontif? Does anybody not make a Shechianu when lighting candles for Yontif? Interesting. Everybody here universally does, and that is the most popular opinion, but it is not a universal opinion. What is the question about making a Shechianu on when lighting candles? The Yavetz, or Yaakov Emden, says it doesn't appear in any of the poskim. It's a relatively modern phenomenon that a woman would make a Shechianu when lighting the candles. Why shouldn't she make a Shechianu when lighting the candles? How does the meal begin? With Kiddush. And what happens at Kiddush? Shechianu. So why isn't she, like her husband, like everyone else at the table, being Yotze with the Shechianu at Kiddush, why is she making a Shechianu earlier? So some, the Yavetz, and others say, in fact, she should not. Rav Shechter, Mori V'Rabbi Rav Shechter, Paskins, and his wife, observes not to make a Shechianu at candle lighting. She fulfills the Shechianu at Kiddush. And I checked with his son today because I wanted to confirm that was in fact his opinion. And he told me that when his father married his mother, this was the one thing he asked of her. If they were going to get married, would she agree to that practice, not to make a Shechianu at candle lighting? Which, this didn't come up when we were dating for some reason. But not to make a Shechianu at candle lighting and to only be Yotze with a Shechianu at Kiddush. So we take it as mainstream and normative that a woman makes a Shechianu at candle lighting. It's not universal and not everybody agrees. Some say that a woman should not make the Shechianu at candle lighting. She should wait at Kiddush. And why should she wait till Kiddush? Because if she makes the Shechianu earlier, now you've got a problem. And what's the problem? Her husband's going to interrupt Kiddush with a Shechianu. How can she be Yotze Kiddush if it's an interruption of something she didn't need to say? First of all, she didn't need to say maybe it's an interruption. And moreover, should you answer Amen? So you're answering Amen to Kiddush, do you answer Amen to the Shehecheyanu? So there are poskim who say, if a woman makes the Shehecheyanu a candle lighting, do not answer Amen at Kiddush to Shehecheyanu. Answer Amen to the rest of Kiddush, don't answer Amen to the Shehecheyanu, because that would be a hefsek, that would be an interruption, since you are not obligated, you've already fulfilled the mitzvah of Shehecheyanu. Rav Moshe Feinstein is lenient. And Rav Moshe says, no, the Shehecheyanu was instituted as part of Kiddush. Even if you've been Yotzei already, you can answer Amen nonetheless. So again, the mainstream practice is women light candles and say Shehecheyanu, and then they answer Amen to their husband's Shehecheyanu at Kiddush. That's the mainstream practice, and if it's your practice, you should continue it. But know that not everybody agrees, and there are opinions who say a woman should dafka not make a Shehecheyanu because she's going to be fulfilling it later with her husband at Kiddush. But back to the kitchen and our preparations. So, we're allowed to cook. It's the exception. It's the one malacha we're allowed to do on Yontif. However, there's certain criteria to be able to do this malacha. It has to be something which is shava l'chol nefesh. It says, achi achel, you can do it l'chol nefesh. So something the Gemara learns, shava l'chol nefesh. The only type of malacha you're allowed to do for the purpose of cooking is something which is universally done. But if you do it and nobody else really does it, then you do not have the opening to be able to do it. Which brings us to the question of showering on Yontif. In order to take a hot shower on Yontif, what do you need to do? You have to have hot water. So you'll say, well, I'm allowed to heat water for my coffee, tea, I'm allowed to cook on Yontif. So if I can cook for eating, why can't I cook for some other activity? Now, the showering is not cooking, so the heter is only cooking. So here we have a principle called mitoch. Mitoch tells us, anything I could do in the context of cooking, I'm also allowed to do not for cooking. So, for example, one year, 2005, I believe it was, we had a hurricane on Hoshana Rabbah, and we spent the second days of Sukkot literally in the dark. We were without power for 5 or 6 days. If you've moved to the community since then, trust me, you do not want to go through that. It wasn't pleasant. It brought the whole community together. There were a million brachas that came out of it, but I don't wish it on anybody. 5 days without power, air conditioning, lights, and nothing to maintain your freezer and refrigerator. There was barbecues galore. It was enormous street parties. Everyone had to barbecue everything they had. It was a very lebedik. It was a very exciting time. So on that Yontif, it was also a very romantic time because the only way that you could have meals was with candlelight. They were candlelight meals. All the meals were candlelight. It is a miracle for which we should be very grateful that no house on Montoya Circle or anywhere in Palm Beach County burnt down, because the only way we lit our home was for Yontif meals with kids running around and playing. There were candles everywhere. That's how we ate. Those who were here then remember it. So were we allowed to light candles in order to illuminate the room to see? Why? That's not for eating purposes. So why were you allowed to light, again, from an existing flame? You couldn't light a new flame, but from an existing flame you could light a new flame. Why were we allowed to do that? Because of the principle mitoch. Something which is permissible, mitoch chahutra, l'tzarech ochel nefesh, hutra nami shelo l'tzarech ochel nefesh. Since it became permissible in the context of preparing food, it is permissible even not in the context of preparing food, so i.e. to illuminate and be able to. But however, that's qualified. You're allowed to do something even not in the context of heating food, as long as it's shava l'chol nefesh. Something which is universally practiced. So, the question is showering every day universally practiced? Heating the water is not a problem. Mitoch, from the fact that you could heat water to cook on Yontif, you could heat water to shower or bathe on Yontif. But is it something that's universally practiced? So some say that today showering is ubiquitous. Everybody showers. It's hygienic. People shower more often. We all have the status of istinus. It's become shava l'chol nefesh. You're allowed to shower today on Yontif. You do have to be careful that you only use liquid soap. And even that, Rav Moshe says you should dilute with water. Only use, obviously, a shampoo that you dilute with water. You can't use a bar of soap. There's a technical malacha in using a bar of soap of memachik, mareach. You're a malacha in using a bar of soap. So you have to use liquid soap, which is diluted. You have to not rub it into your hair, but simply pat it on your hair. And most significantly, when you dry off, you have to try to drip dry or pat dry, but you can't. This is a problem I thankfully do not have. Schita, you're not allowed to wring out all the water absorbed in your luscious hair. Not a problem that I have. So, you're allowed, you have these technical challenges of showering on Yontif, which is, you can only use liquid soap, not a bar of soap, diluted liquid soap. You can't rub it into your hair, but you should simply place it on your hair, let the water clean it out. And when you dry it, you have to not squeeze the water out from a place it was absorbed. But if you can navigate those other details, many say it's Shavu L'chol Nefesh today, showering. People do it regularly, so you can shower. Some say you should use lukewarm water, not absolutely hot water, because of another consideration, which we're not going to get into. And that is the opinion of many, including Mori V'Rabbi Rav Shecht, who feels it's permissible to shower, maybe even obligatory. Certainly a three-day yontif, if you regularly shower, to shower on yontif. The Mishnah Berurah quotes already that all agree, if you regularly bathe your children every day, you can bathe children on yontif. Even those who believe that showering is not yet Shavu L'chol Nefesh, that even though obviously we do it with much more frequency, in antiquity they showered once a year, believe it or not. And then more recent times they showered once a month. And some places they shower, like yeshivas, once a week. And we hope that we shower every day, but not everybody showers every day. So there's a debate. Do you say that showering every day is Shavu L'chol Nefesh? And there are many poskim who say it's not yet. Maybe never will be Shavu L'chol Nefesh, normative or universal to do every day. But even those who are strict and say that you shouldn't shower on Yontif agree, like the Mishnah Berurah, that young children who are bathed daily can be bathed on Yontif as well. Okay, so we spoke about Shachianu, Shavu L'chol Nefesh, Mitoch, even for things not cooking, i.e., bathing or showering would be permissible. Now let's get back to cooking. Someone had a question. Yes.
Okay, so I've always had, I was going to fight against my daughter about my friends wash their hair.
Right.
I can't wash
no, you can. You can if you can navigate those other technical reasons.
I mean, you have long hair.
Right. You have long hair, but yeah, it's a big.
No, I'm just saying, like, how does a normal person not?
So you can't lather up with shampoo and then you're going to come out and you're used to wringing it out and wrapping it up and squeezing out the water. If you're going to do all that, then don't even come close to doing it because you're flirting with violating a real violation. But if you can be confident that you're going to simply, you know, take from the bottle and put it in a few places and then stand under the water and let it wash it out, and when you come out, you're going to let it drip dry or you'll simply pat, but you're not going to squeeze out, then it would be something which is permissible. But getting back to cooking. So how does this all apply in the kitchen? So we spoke about, you can't prepare from one day to the next. So what if you're going to... So even though Rosh Hashanah is considered Yom Ha'arechta, in some regards, in others, we still preserve the prohibition of preparing from one day to the next. Just like we're saying a Shechianu that second night, we also can't prepare from one day to the next. So let's say you have young kids and you want to feed them. What do you do if you can't prepare from one day to the next? You're going to have a lot of guests. So we have something, we have a heter, which is the following. Very interesting. We have a heter that if you're cooking on the first day, and really all you need is a pot that has meatballs for five people, but for dinner that night, or the next day for that matter, you're going to have 20 people, you can fill the pot with meatballs enough for 20 people. It's a harama, it's a legal loophole. Even though you don't really need it for that meal, but the pot's better. The more food in it, the more flavor there is, the better it is. You're not putting up a second pot, so then you're allowed to expand the portions that you're preparing for that day that you're cooking, even though it will mean, and even though in your mind, you will have enough for the next day. You shouldn't pronounce it out loud. You can't articulate it. Oh, bring me more. I want to have enough meatballs for tonight. Let's, you know, or I'm cooking this huge pot so we have enough for tonight or for tomorrow. If you articulate it out loud, then you've undermined it. But the heter is, you're allowed to expand the quantity or the portion, even if it means you will then have enough for that night or for the next or for the next day. You're also allowed to, if you're going to feed your children early, you're allowed to heat up the food from that night because you're not preparing for that night. You're actually enabling your children to participate, to partake of it then. You can't do that as, you know, you're going to heat it up and then take a tiny little piece. You're not really using it. You know, you're not fooling Hashem. Don't try to fool yourself or fool anybody else. But generally speaking, it's prohibited to prepare from one day to the next. So you can't set the table for the night meal yet. You cannot heat up the food for that next meal yet. We also don't even light candles. Because if you light candles the first day, there's a debate about this too. Some are of the opinion that you could light candles early because that will enhance even the first day. But most are of the opinion that we wait to light candles until it's the second day, so we will not have been preparing from one day to the next. Yes?
Specifically with food, is this
the sweet things? Oh, great. I wasn't going to mention it, but I'm glad you raised it. There is a custom, it's quoted in the referenced by the Shulchan Aruch among the many customs we have, not to eat nuts on Rosh Hashanah. We don't eat egos. Why don't we eat egos on Rosh Hashanah? Because egos is the same gematria as chait. So this is my favorite Kotzker Rebbe. I love the Kotzker. The Kotzker had sharp, witty insights. Every Kutzker is sharp and witty. So I usually post this every year around this time. Thank you for reminding me. The Kutzker said, here we're also careful that our recipes and the ingredients and all of our Rosh Hashanah meals, we don't have any nuts. Why? Because egos is gematria chet. He says, you know what else is gematria chet? Chet. Be careful also not to do chet. It's a great Kutzker. It's easy to not eat nuts. So we skip nuts because it's a gematria chet. You know what else is gematria chet? Chet. Chet means a sin, a violation, something wrong. So don't do chet. So here we have meals, goes back to how we began. We have meals where we're not eating nuts and we're acting nutty. We're busy saying Lashon Hara and gossip and judgmental and ranking the chazan and rating the rabbi's drasha and rating our seat and rating the thermostat, what it was set to. And all we're filled with is negativity. Egos is chet, gematria chet. You know what else? Chet is also gematria chet. We have to be careful of that at the meals. So coming back to now cooking, operating in the kitchen. So let's start with gas. Gas stoves. So if your gas stove is ancient and still has a pilot light, so you're allowed to light a flame from a pre-existing flame. You'd be allowed to light your gas stove from the existing pilot light. Can you lower it or put it out? Could you lower it or turn it off? So the halacha is that if the food being on the high flame, it will burn the food, then lowering it is for the purpose of cooking, i.e. not destroying your food. If you finish cooking, you're now prohibited from lowering it. That's a malacha called kibui, extinguishing. And that's not what tzorach ochel nefesh anymore because you're done cooking. So you're only allowed to, you could raise a flame for the purpose of cooking. You could lower the flame to avoid burning food, but you cannot lower the flame in order to save on your fuel or because you're afraid of the danger. You're not allowed to in that, you're not allowed to in that case. You're not allowed to turn it out all the way, nor are you allowed to lower it. When we had the hurricane, we had to, on the fly, answer a lot of shaylos and did not have the benefit at the time of having Rabbi Flug, who knows everything, live here. So how did everybody cook? Those who were here remember. You didn't have access. Most people had electric stoves, electric ovens. So the barbecue. People were making, they were baking cookies in their barbecue. People were making challah in their barbecue. It was, as I said, a very exciting time. So the question was, if on Yontif, the only way that you could be cooking and having access to hot food is through your barbecue, and you're done barbecuing, could you lower the flame? And could you make the argument, which I argued you could, and afterwards confirmed with Rav Schechter, who agreed, Baruch Hashem, that it was correct. There, lowering the flame was tzorach ochel nefesh, because you wouldn't have hot food at the next meal. You wouldn't have cooked food at the next meal if you didn't preserve some of the propane in the tank to be able to cook. But in your kitchen, lowering the flame is not for the purpose of the next meal. You're not going to run out of gas. So you're not allowed to lower it. So here's the trick. Leave your food on. When you're ready to lower or turn off the flame, leave your food on for a little bit, whereas if you have the high flame, it'll burn it. You can lower it not to burn your food, and that's how you've lowered the flame. It's a little trick to be able to lower the flame. That's all with a gas stove. Yes?
What
about a non-Jew? You shouldn't ask a non-Jew to do it either, because a non-Jew can't do for you anything you can't do yourself. There are certain exceptions to that rule. We have a whole area, maybe we'll get to some of those tonight, but that would not be one of them. Okay, gas stove. Any questions about a gas stove? You could raise a flame, you could light a flame from an existing flame to cook, you could lower a flame to avoid burning, but you cannot lower or extinguish the flame just because you're done cooking. That's a gas stove. What about an electric stove? Yes?
But couldn't one say, remove the food from the flame?
In order to avoid it from burning.
Yeah.
Right, so I'm saying lower it at the point where you still want it to be heated, but if you had that high flame, it's going to burn. If you don't like my legal loophole, then just leave the flame on. No, I understand. But I'm saying, you could just leave the flame on and take the food off. But if you want to find a way that is permissible to lower the flame, that would be a mechanism. That would be one of the ways to be able to do it. What about an electric range? Most people, I imagine, today have electric ranges. So electric ranges are following. If you knew that there was an electric flow to your range at that moment, you could raise it. Because all you're doing is expanding the electric flow, which is like raising the flame. It's permissible. And lowering it, you'd have the same problem of extinguishing. But if you knew that the electric flow was off, then you could lower it and even turn it all the way off because you're not doing anything. So here's the major problem, and you need to examine your own stove and call the manufacturer. Some stovetops have an indicator light to tell you whether it's on or not. The problem is, can you trust it? And what do I mean? Not that the company's lying to you, but what is the light really indicating? What is the light really communicating? Is the light telling you if there's an electric flow to it, or is the light telling you if it's reached its desired temperature or not? So you turn the stove on high, and the light is on. Sometimes the light will be on, and it tells you it reached the temperature, even though it just kicked off because it reached the temperature. So the light's on to tell you it reached the high temperature, but the electric flow stopped because it doesn't need the electric flow anymore because it reached the temperature. And if you were to operate based on the light, and therefore raise it, you'd actually be starting it, which is a problem. A problem of starting an electric flow or closing an electric circuit. And the inverse is also true. If the light's off, you may assume there's no electric flow right now. But the light being off might mean, right, the opposite. So the question is the light really telling you whether there's an electric flow, or is the light really a function of reaching its desired temperature and not telling you the flow? And if it's not telling you the flow and you're wrong and you turn it on or off, you could have a significant problem. What would that significant problem be? So here we have a big machlokas. What is the problem of electricity on Shabbos or Yontif? So according to some, the Chazon Ish holds it's boneh. It's like building. When you close a circuit, you've created a building, a binyan. It's boneh. Others say it's makeh bepatish. It's the final hammer blow. You are rendering something which was useless into useful. Others say it's like molid. You're creating, you're giving birth to something new. Others say it's a problem of havara, of burning something, or if you make metal glow. Others say it's a problem of bishul, you're cooking. What is the consensus? So most don't agree with the Chazon Ish that it's boneh or makeh bepatish, but according to most, electricity is an issur d'oraisa. So if there's no electrically closed circuit, if there's no electricity flowing to your stovetop or your oven, and you raise it, and now it kicks it in to close it, you've violated a biblical prohibition, or rabbinic prohibition, but likely a biblical prohibition, regarding closing that electric circuit and starting an electric flow. So you need to know your product. You need to know your appliance. And if your appliance is really indicating whether there's an electric flow or not, you could rely on that. So if the electricity is flowing to it, you could raise it. If the electricity is not flowing to it, you could lower it or even turn it all the way off. But if you know whether the electricity is flowing or not, you're entitled to operate based on that knowledge. But if you don't know, then you're stuck. To which my suggestion is leave one on high and one on low and work between the two. And don't adjust anything on Yontif. Or cook all your food before Yontif and just heat it on your plata like you normally do on Shabbos. And take all this out of the equation. Yes? Yes. You can put your burner on a Shabbos clock, and if it... Can you do that with a...
Not with a range, but with a portable burner.
Yeah, a portable burner you can put on a Shabbos clock, absolutely, and then operate in that way. Yes, yes. Which is... When it's off, you can turn it all the way off. Yeah, exactly. Because there's no electric flow to it. You know that when it's off. We're going to talk about the timer again when it comes to an urn. Well, let's go right into the urn. Yes?
The electric oven, stove top, the same as a glass top?
A glass top, yeah, because a glass top is an electric. It's just under the glass.
On mine, it just says hot.
Right, so that's a problem. So you can't rely on... That's telling you about thermostat. It's not telling you about electric flow. And without absolute knowledge of electric flow, you have to be strict to assume that you can't adjust.
You cannot adjust it at all.
So can't adjust it at all. Correct. And right now, there is no Shabbos mode for a range, to the best of my knowledge. There are Shabbos mode ovens we'll talk about, which are totally, totally mislabeled. They're Yontif mode, not Shabbos mode. I love the Starkade, but you have to change the name. But I don't believe that there's a Yontif mode stovetop, which would be great, which would enable us to be adjusting it and manipulating it. For now, you either need to know from the manufacturer what the light is telling you, or you can hire an electrician who will put in an indicator light to tell you whether there's an electric flow or not. Although it's complicated. That's the stovetop. This all applies to an urn too. How does it apply to a hot water urn? If the water in your hot water urn is low, can you put more water in? So I would have thought, it's Yontif, you're allowed to cook on Yontif, absolutely. What would be the problem of putting cold water in? Cooking. But here's the problem. The problem is, if the hot water urn was at its desired temperature and there's no electric flow, if the element is not heating at that moment, when you put the cold water in, it's not a problem of cooking, it's a problem of closing an electric circuit, of creating electricity. And the light may or may not help you there. So the poskim all say that you're not allowed to add water to the hot water urn for that reason. Again, it's complicated, but it's getting late at night, so I won't tell you that there's two heating elements. There's the initial heating element, and there's the maintenance heating element. There's a lot of detail to this, but take me at my word. You wouldn't be allowed to. So how do you get around it? So the CRC actually has worked with the electric pump one and other urns, and they know which ones you would be allowed to add water to. If you look on the CRC, you'll see that they did some work on that. Or there's two other ways you could do it. One is, if you heat the water on your stove, you could put the hot water in your urn because that won't make it kick in. So you could add hot water to your urn, you'll do it that way. Or alternatively, another good suggestion Rabbi Fuli gave me this is, put your hot water urn on a timer. And that way, when the hot water urn timer kicks it to go on, you know it's going to have to heat again. And at the moment that you know it's going to have to heat again, you can add more water because you're adding the water is not what's making it heat again. The timer is what made it heat again. It means, though, that whenever the timer had it off, you don't have hot water. So you may not like that suggestion. You may like the other one. Or just get a really big hot water urn so you don't run out over Yontif. If you have boiling water, you could use it if you have a boiler. If you have, in other words, the Instahot, I think we said you can use on Yontif. What's the mechanism? There's no light which is closing, and it is heating. The Instahots are constructed in a way that I believe we do say you could use it on Yontif. And if you have a boiler, also, you could release hot water. That's how you're showering on Yontif. If you have a, what are the new ones they call today? It doesn't hold any water in the boiler. It's, what are they called?
Is it tankless?
Tankless, the tankless water heaters. The tankless water heater is more complicated. So to use hot water on Yontif, if you have a tankless water heater, is halachically more complicated than if you have a boiler that's filled with water. Okay, let's get to the oven. We don't have that. We have a boiler. Don't worry, you're good. Yeah, if you have like hot water, you could use that too. Yeah. No, I didn't yet. Yeah, if you have that, like, yeah, if you have Zephyr Hills. Zephyr Hills here. Yeah, you have. Yes. Okay, what about the oven? You'd have to exist from, right, you couldn't use the electricity, right, correct. So if you have a gas stove and you don't have a pilot light that it's being lit from, you cannot use the electric ignition to light it. You'd have to light it from an existing flame. You'd have to light it from an existing flame. Okay, what about the ovens? So, as I said, it's somewhat of a misnomer because the Shabbos mode oven doesn't do anything for you for Shabbos. It does one thing for you for Shabbos, which is, well, it doesn't really do anything for you for Shabbos. It keeps the light off in the oven, and it allows you to open the oven door. It doesn't impact the oven whatsoever, but that would be okay to remove food from the oven anyway. The Shabbos mode, Yontif mode oven, helps you on Yontif. When it's on the Yontif mode, you can adjust it. Why can you adjust it? It's an electric panel. So it's a big chiddush of Rav Heinemann. The reason you can adjust it is grumma. It's an indirect effect. It's an indirect result from whatever you're doing to control that panel, to manipulate that panel. So when you press the buttons, there's nothing on the display. There's nothing that interacts with you. It's all happening behind the scenes in a way that nobody can see or appreciate. It's internal to the oven. And it doesn't kick in immediately. It's grumma. It's indirect. It takes time before what you've done registers and makes it kick in. So the fact that you don't see anything, the fact that there's no display, the fact that it's all happening internally and not being recorded, it's not like typing on a computer but not having it attached to a computer monitor where it's still being recorded. It's not being recorded in the oven. It's not being displayed on the display. And it's not happening directly right then. Those three things in combination are what make the Shabbos mode, the Yontif mode oven, that you're allowed to manipulate the oven on Yontif, to be able to manipulate the temperature of the oven on Yontif. If you do not have a Shabbos mode oven, then and it's an electric oven, then you have a problem. For the same reason, in terms of not knowing whether there's an electric flow or desired temperature and whether you're closing a circuit by raising it or even by lowering it. Okay, or Stephanie's questions here.
I have a question.
Yes, please.
About the oven.
You're really not supposed to have the non-Jew turn it on. Again, the general principle is anything you can't do, you can't ask a non-Jew to do for you. There are exceptions to that rule. There's a whole separate five-hour talk we could do about Amira La'akam, what you're allowed to ask the non-Jew. But the general rule is anything you can't do, you can't ask the non-Jew to do. Just like Shabbos oven is a misnomer, Shabbos goy is a misnomer. Yes. Yeah. Sure. You don't need a blach on Yontif. You mean like the hot plate, like a plata? Yeah, you could use it with a timer. You don't need to have a timer. You could just leave it on, but you could leave it with a timer too. No problem. Sure.
But then when the light goes on, because of the timer, is that a problem?
On what? No, because the timer is what turned it on. Okay. If the timer is turning it on, it's all programmed from before Shabbos, Yontif, then you're okay. Yes. Yes, that's the practice in our home. Yocheved and I cook everything before Yontif. Mostly her. Okay, entirely her. We cook everything before Yontif. In order to avoid all of this, she should actually be giving this talk, not me. But my understanding is, in order to avoid all the halachic questions, and frankly, in order to enjoy Yontif and not have to be cooking for meals on Yontif, and that's not a luxury everybody has. Some people are working and don't have that time necessarily before Yontif. But in our home, forever, everything is cooked from before Yontif, and it's just a question of heating it, which is like a Shabbos, the difference being you're allowed to heat liquids on Yontif, you don't have to worry about where you put it and how you heat it, and that kind of thing. You could use the oven exactly without a problem. If it's an electric one, no. Again, you have that problem of the creating, closing the circuit and adding the electricity to it. Hot water, and we talked about Blech timer, we talked about Hachana, preparing one day to the next, bathing children, Shabbos mode. Now, if your oven goes off, if you're going to have no access to hot food, then you're allowed to ask a non-Jew to turn it on. That's Tzorach Yontif, Simchas Yontif. So one of the exemptions of the prohibition of Amir La'akum is if you would otherwise not be able to, you'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew. Be allowed to ask a non-Jew. Adjusting the air conditioning. So if you have a thermostat that's non-electric, if you have what's that called? In other words, a little guy you slide back and forth, I think is the technical way to describe it. It's a manual thermostat, it's not an electric thermostat. Then while the air conditioning is on, you can lower the temperature, and while it's off, you'd be allowed to raise the temperature. But if you're working with an electric thermostat, you cannot adjust it on Yontif or Shabbos. Speak up. If you're terribly uncomfortable, and the temperatures here in South Florida can be a health risk if you're terribly uncomfortable, you'd be allowed to ask a non-Jew to adjust the temperature of your thermostat. If your air conditioning broke on Shabbos Yontif, you could have a non-Jew call and have air conditioning company come, because we consider temperature, Moshe has a tshuva when it comes to heating, but the inverse would apply to us. If you've lived without air conditioning this time of year, you know it could be pikuach nefesh, sakonas nefashos, can be dangerous, so you'd be allowed to, that would be one of the exemptions that you could ask a non-Jew. Any other questions? Yes?
If you have
to use right. Yeah, so again, if you can adjust, or Shlomo Zalman says that you can adjust the timer
while it's on.
While it's on, exactly, to delay it going off, exactly.
But you can't add.
Again, not with an electric timer. It's really only those old school timers, which were miserable with the little, like, Monopoly pieces. You know, they had to put in, and you got confused, and they fell, and you can't find them, and put it in the wrong slot, and you confused AM and PM, and yeah, so. The benefit is you can manipulate the manyanta. If the downside is they're miserable and terrible, and thank God we've advanced since then. So coming full circle, these minutiae, the details, how we operate are critically important. Halacha is binding and is meaningful, and it's the foundation of our lives, but it's all a foundation to achieve the enrichment of the higher level. So I wish everybody a mindful and a beautiful and an energized and an enriching and wonderful Yontif. And feel free to ask any questions now afterwards or any other time between now and Yontif as well. Have a great night.